Hello, Mixed Nutcases. This is Nuke Chas, and we are back with an Intro to Ghibli episode for you. With me, my fellow newbie.
Hi, I'm Tech.
And our guides.
Hi, I'm Jason.
And I'm Jen.
And we watched...
Jason ripping off my intro yet again. Now, we watched The Tale of Princess Kaguya.
And I didn't say that because I apparently mispronounce it every time, and I don't even hear the difference.
It's all good. It's all good.
Initial thoughts?
I had fun with this. It was great. Yet again, it's another Takahata movie, and yet again, it was done in a completely different art style than what we're used to, but yet again, Ghibli movies racking up bodies of dead animators as they still happen to be Japan's leading cause of carpal tunnel syndrome. My gosh.
It was gorgeous. It was absolutely gorgeous. I enjoyed the movie as a whole. It has a beginning, middle, and an end, which is high praise for a Ghibli film. And it was really sweet. I liked it. And the art style was, this is how you can make a beautiful art film and still make it a movie. And so I'm happy are my initial thoughts.
So this one, the first time I watched it, made me cry. I mean, I guess there's a lot of Studio Ghiblis that don't make me cry, but this one
makes
me cry.
There's also a lot that do make you cry.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, it's not my favorite Takahata. I think it's his best, but it's not my personal favorite. I would still say Yamada's is my personal favorite, but Kaguya's great. Like, just, I got lucky enough to see it in theaters, and hopefully, this year's Ghibli Fest will put it up there so I can do it again, because I would absolutely see this in theaters again.
Yeah, you don't see it often with the Ghibli Fest where they put them out in theaters. And apparently this was a flop financially, but there's reasons for that. But before we get into that, Tech, do we have a textile summary?
Yeah, so Hayao Miyazaki let Isao Takahata out of his cage one last time to direct what ended up being the last full-length movie of his career, in which they retell a classic Japanese fairy tale called The Tale of the Bamboo Cutter. This is a story that is over 1,000 years old, or almost 1,000 years old. It's the oldest surviving fairy tale in this genre. The story has been told many, many times. There was a 1935 movie. It's been in print multiple times in different sort of iterations. It gets its feature length animated version here in, 2014, I think? 2013?
2013, yeah.
And it's, the very known fairy tale of the moon princess Kaguya coming down to Earth, and, hijinks ensue. But shorter and more succinctly, it's they let Takahata out of his cage, and he's like, oh, Miyazaki's had a string of hits? Miyazaki killed a bunch of animators? I think I can top this body count. How many people can I kill in one movie? And then all of the animators are like, oh, but Takahata's going to be nice to us. He's going to let us do a movie with watercolors and pencil crayons. It's going to be so much easier than doing cel shade animation. Incorrect, my friends.
Incorrect.
It was not easier, was it?
We're going to do both. Have fun. Yeah. Oh, by the way, I'm going to have soirees where the character does nothing to propel the story, but it's just my visions.
I need to know if Takahata is going to stay retired.
He passed.
Dead. He's dead.
He did.
Oh, yeah. Stay retired.
Yeah. This is his last film.
Yeah, he did this one. This was his last that he made. And then remember the one, The Red Turtle, where there's no dialogue? He produced that.
Okay.
And that was the last thing he did, and then that was it. And to be fair, I think they treat him like an NBA player. They had him, they put him on the bench for a while to conserve him and then let him.
They always do. They do that a lot.
Yeah, he was like credited as like executive art director or something for Red Turtle, which I think was basically he was acting as babysitter to their new film director that did The Red Turtle, which was a success, and I hear it was a beautiful movie. And shortly after that, he passed away of lung cancer. So, you never know. You never know with a Miyazaki film. You never know with Studio Ghibli. Like, they could find a way to resurrect the zombie of Isao Takahata and do Grave of the Fireflies Part 2 or something. Who knows?
Yeah, absolutely kill all of our souls.
Right. Like, this was a commercial flop. It cost like almost $50 million and only made half.
Yeah.
But critically, it was a massive hit. Like, critics loved this thing.
100% rating and 97 critic review on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like unheard of.
And Jason, you were saying this got an Oscar nod too.
Yep, same year. It and to be fair, it lost to Great Company. It lost to Big Hero 6, yep.
Which we were just talking about this before. Like, Big Hero 6 is an amazing movie. There's a reason
you can't
won.
Be mad
it
at Big Hero 6.
Great.
Yeah, you can't be mad at it. Like, it's Big Hero 6. I mean, and Song of the Sea was up there that year too. Like, that's a really good one too. So, like, it was in Great Company.
Yeah,
yeah. It was a good year for animation. Apparently, Studio Ghibli set up a separate studio entirely for Takahata to do this film. And this is the most expensive Japanese film, the most expensive animated film. It's somewhere in the $43-47 million or something like that.
Why is it that every Ghibli movie, as we march through time, is like, this is the most expensive animated movie ever made?
Yeah. But, It was because it was all the Sumi-e watercolor paintings, yeah. And they were animating watercolors. Like, yeah. It is insane.
Well, I put in the chat a picture of a traditional watercolor painting from a children's book in 1908, done in that traditional watercolor style of Princess Kaguya. And when we think of the movie that we just watched, it looks just like
it looks just painting. Like her. Yeah,
it's amazing. It's watching a moving watercolor.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that the watercolor was literally a nod to the original. Because, mm-hmm. like Tech was saying, this is one of the oldest still recorded stories,
yep.
Painting-wise. So I'm kind of hoping that the whole watercolor painting was a nod to that. They did it beautifully.
Yeah, it's a classic story. It's a classic story done in a classic style. It would be kind of like if they did... if you did, like, the stories of the Brothers Grimm, but you did them all in, like, woodblock cuttings.
Yeah.
And then try to animate woodblocks, which would be really cool.
All right, film student, get on it.
Film students.
But no, man.
I was wrong. That 49.3 million U.S.
But doing this entire movie in classic, classic Japanese watercolor styles and... all of the lines, like they're all, you can see that it's all like pencil crayon on canvas, and you can see the lines of the canvas in the animation. And I know that this isn't like everybody's style. This is a very, very much an art piece. This is not like Totoro or Howl's Moving Castle or Princess Mononoke, which are all very beautifully done, but they're all classic cel shaded animation. This is something completely different. This is traditional Japanese art telling a traditional Japanese story, but it's so pretty. Like, racking every scene. Like, there's one particular scene in the movie where the princess runs away from home. And it's done in this, like, harsh black, white, and red style as she's running pell-mell through the woods to run away. And it's just gorgeous. And it's all done in, like 8 frames a second. It's done really, really choppy because that's what it looks like when you're full of adrenaline and you're running through tears in your eyes and you're super scared as you're running. And
if you think watercolors cannot be emotive, you're very, very wrong. There are so many things that Kaguya does with what Takahata does with Kaguya's face that is out of this world. Like, sure, this was a financial flop, but every dollar's on the screen. Like, I can't say that for certain people with these really, really, really big budgets. I can't say that about some of these films.
And the other thing is there's, The other side of it is that it is it's culturally significant, as we were saying, but like they got in the Japanese cast and the English cast top actors, like not just one or two. Everybody is somebody. And apparently, like the best actor in Japan did a very small role because it was Takahata doing it. Mm-hmm. And so much of what they show is so historically accurate. And we're talking about traditions and customs of a time period that is very well known in Japan. So like this is a nod to history. It's a nod to culture. It's a nod to everything. And so so it didn't make more than 30 million in the box office or in physical sales on media, but it's going to be one of these things that's going to stick around for a while. You know, sometimes something that's a financial flop becomes more significant over time. And this this is one of those.
This is a historically and culturally significant movie. It is a significant piece of art. And I was just thinking about it this way. Like those big Marvel Cinematic Universe Avengers movies, they're getting up into the $200 and $300 million mm-hmm. dollars of production. Now they make their money back. These make billions of dollars. They're the most popular movies in history. And you know what? They're good popcorn flicks. I'm not taking anything away from them. But as a movie, what would you guys rather watch? Six different Princess Kaguyas made for $50 million a piece or one Avengers flick?
Listen,
I know what I'm picking.
You know, it's, again, people forget that Studio Ghibli is not just Miyazaki. Like, they forget all the time. Like, people talk about it almost like a myth or a legend about Grave of the Fireflies. They talk about it. They talk about it like it is
early. That was in the 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's like that was when they were forming Ghibli, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, this is the thing. Like, they forget that he co-founded this thing. It wasn't just Miyazaki. Like, anime fans know of Grave of the Fireflies because it's gut wrenching. Like,
but that's also infamous. A taboo movie when you think of Studio Ghibli.
You know, but my thing is, I don't think there's anything Miyazaki could ever have made. The only way he could make something on that level is if he had killed Little May at the end of Totoro. Like if he had done that, then you'd be talking about Totoro like you would talk about Grave of the Fireflies. And here's the worst reality of it. They were a double feature together when they came out. So that should speak to what the ending might have really been at the end of Totoro. I'm just saying.
Which one did you watch first, though?
I don't know, man. Like,
because imagine, okay, so like, if you watch Grave of the Fireflies first, and then you're leaving that movie with all these heavy emotions, you watch Totoro, and you're expecting another downer, and it ends on kind of a happy note. That's okay, but if you watch Totoro first, and you're like, oh, Totoro, Totoro, my heart is full and happy, and I saw monsters. Let's watch the firebombing of Kobe live. You know?
Yeah. Takahata was exceptional. And I think this is exactly why. And I think you can use a lot of money. Like, let's not get it twisted. A lot of money does make movies better sometimes, but like only when it's used right. And obviously he used it very, very well to pay the pensions of so many murdered animators.
Oh man. Like I said, Studio Ghibli, leading cause of carpal tunnel syndrome in Japan right now, probably worldwide. The amount of animators' wrists they must have shattered drawing all of these scenes and doing all of this as watercolor. It is unbelievably pretty from the very, very beginning. And, hey, Nutty, how far into the plot do you want to go with this?
Go.
So the story, it's an old fairy tale. It's a bamboo cutter out in the woods doing his bamboo cutting job. And as he cuts a bamboo stalk, it blooms and blossoms, it grows in front of his eyes, and there's a little baby inside it. And he takes the little baby back home, and the baby starts to grow unnaturally quickly. And the bamboo cutter and his wife adopt this little princess as their own. And she grows up. This is like she's aging like unbelievably quickly. And then he goes back into the woods, and he finds, as I cut bamboo down, it's like I find money, and I find fancy clothing, and I find fancy gifts. I guess this is a sign from the gods that I must raise her as a princess. So he builds a palace and he moves to the city and he's raising her and he hires a coach to teach her how to be an aristocratic princess. And then probably my favorite part of the story. And then, it's the crux of the story is that as she grows up and as she becomes a young woman and she becomes of age, is that she is beset by suitors, five suitors. And she gives upon each of them an impossible task to prove that they are worthy of taking her hand in marriage. To which point she sabotages all of their attempts because hashtag strong women. And proceeds to sabotage them all and ruin all of their chances. And then attracts the attention of Rapey the Emperor. I mean...
Yeah, that's a good term for him.
Of... toxic masculinity in personified as Dean Cain doing the Emperor's voice. Oof. And
superb casting.
And more hilarity ensues, and we it goes from there. But God, this movie's so pretty. That's all I want to talk about.
Okay, number one, Dad should have just listened to her and raised her out in the country because she never would have wished to go away. The problem is she was so upset that the moon heard her and came to take her back. So she could have stayed longer if Dad just listened to her. Also, this is definitely giving us a glimpse into a period of time when it's just commonplace for men to have many wives. If you're rich, you got lots of wives. And apparently, even if you're poor, that's okay. You can leave your wife and your kid behind. The farm boy that she loves. Yeah. He sees her as an adult and he's totally ready to just leave his wife.
He totally does.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Abandons baby and just walks into the field to go on a magical Peter Pan-esque style flying sequence, which totally isn't them having sex.
Totally not. Mm-hmm.
As they fly around and, you know, do this Peter Pan type thing, and then poof, he's back in the field and, oh, there's my baby and my wife. Oh, hi, guys. Totally missed you. Totally didn't try to cheat on you.
Didn't try to leave you. Yeah.
To him, it was a dream.
See, the thing is, right, like, one of the things that I love about this is that they show her beauty as being a curse. Like her, mm-hmm. her otherworldliness drives mortals crazy. It makes them go to the ends of the earth. Well, no matter what, to try to please her and get her.
Yeah. And even then it's sight unseen.
Yeah.
It's just on the sound of her voice, because every time the suitors go to see her, by the rules of etiquette of the time, she's always veiled away like through like a bamboo partition. So they never see her, but they're like, oh, we heard that she's gorgeous and lovely. And even when the one guy at the party is like, well, we don't even know what she looks like. What if she's an uggo? And then he gets like beaten down by everybody. Yeah. It's like, no, she must be gorgeous.
Sutomaru, the farm boy, when he gets caught by it, he even says, hey, I thought I heard you say something. I thought I heard you sing it. Yeah. So when he goes to find her towards the end, it's because he heard her singing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, like, even he now is no longer insusceptible to her curse. Like, and I think it's because he fell in love with someone else. I think he was the only one that actually cared about her.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was immune, right? But when he fell in love with someone else, because remember, he forgets her every time she disappears, right?
So we watched the...
Really?
I don't think he forgets that he was ever immune. I don't think that... like immune is the right word for it, because he grew up with her. He grew up watching her, and you could see all the while she was growing up, his feelings for her.
Mm-hmm.
So later on, when he saw her grown up, just when she was in the carriage and he was stealing dinner, you can see that he still had feelings for her.
He's the only one that legitimately cared about her.
Yeah.
Right.
But I also think that, like, even as a baby right away, everybody's just willing to adore and love her. Like, the kids are watching her. The mom is like, oh, you brought home some baby and you're telling me you found it in a bamboo shoot? Sure, I believe you. everybody's just so willing to adopt her because she does have something about her, something otherworldly. And that is probably, you know, it really does feel like it's part of the story. But, for her, you know, she's in this world where after you get your name, after you're an adult, you're not supposed to be seen by outsiders if you're a lady. They never see you till your wedding day, right? And then you belong to them. And she didn't want to belong to them. She wanted to be with her family. She wanted to be with her friends. She never wanted to belong. So there is this feminist storyline right here. And who are the good guys? These are the kids she grew up with who always just saw her as her. You know, they didn't want her to be anything special.
Yeah, it's very interesting that the only people who genuinely care for her are the people from the country. Even her father, as misguided as he is in his attempts, he's still doing it out of unmitigated love for her. And so they're the only ones in this story that actually care about her. You can even see that the people who are coming to take her do not care about her actual feelings. They make her forget them.
Oh, and that scene made me so mad, too.
I think this is why.
That she had to forget them is very upsetting.
So
it wasn't even that she had to forget them. She asked for just a couple more minutes.
Yep.
And, like, she knew as soon as she put on the robe, she would forget everything and everything about the earth. So when she said she just wanted a couple more minutes to say goodbye to the people that had raised her
mm-hmm.
from said bamboo shoot up until this adult woman that we see now, and they wrap her in the cloak and she loses all emotion, yep. all memory, all everything. Like, she loses everything that she had been.
but she looks back.
Yes,
she did.
But I love the fact that when she does look back, it is not in time to see
anything.
Yeah.
The question that I've got is, so we watched the American dub.
Before you go into that, I just want to add on to when she looks back, that's that everything comes around again. That was the overarching theme. Everything comes around again. She went to the earth because there was a woman who remembered the feelings she had on earth. And so she broke the rules and came to earth. So when she looks back, that tells us she's going to come back.
She's going to do it again. Yeah.
Go ahead.
We watched the American dub. Princess Kaguya was voiced in English by Chloe Grace Moretz, which I think if I did my math right, she was 16 at the time she did this. And she has a wonderful voice. She's a gifted actress and did a marvelous job. You know, everybody is falling in love with her voice. And Chloe Moretz just acted the crap out of this and gave us a voice that you could all fall in love with. But my question is, did you guys in any of your research or does anybody know, did she also provide the voice for all the singing parts or did they get somebody else to do the singing?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because there's quite a bit of music in this. There's the whole thing is that she has this latent memory of a, it's almost like a lullaby of just this beautiful, soft song that she sings to herself and that her mother sings to her and and it's repeated many times throughout the movie and it's sung beautifully. I just don't know if Chloe Moretz can actually sing or if they got somebody else to do the singing part.
I don't know.
I wouldn't be surprised either way. You know,
yeah.
It's one of these things. I don't know. And
unfortunately, like a lot of times they don't always tell us when it's somebody else doing the singing. So I'll do a little bit of a look. And I only recently found out that, you know, because I was always saying, is that George Clooney and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou or not? Because like if you look at the credits, you can't find it out that answer. And I just found out it's not him. It's not actually him, some country singer. Yeah. So I don't know.
It would be really interesting if she did, because like that's a lot to put on a young actress, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, again, I don't think Takahata and Studio Ghibli or Disney care about that either. Like, I don't think, listen, they will break the bank to make something great. And honestly, they did with this. Like, you know, this, to think how many good feministic stories have come out from the Studio Ghibli. Like, I mean, Miyazaki's got what? Two, if not three, I think? He's got Spirited Away, Kiki's Delivery Service, and then Takahata's got this. That's a lot coming from these two boys.
As stereotypically toxic and sexist as Japanese culture can be portrayed to be, and sometimes is, Studio Ghibli, for all of its senior leadership and for all the people making movies, there's no, like, these aren't being made by women. These are being made by men. My God, can they write women? And my God, can they tell good coming of age girl stories?
Or how about the animation of Little Bebe?
Oh, her
oh,
like,
my
like
goodness,
toddling around
leapfrogging.
Oh my gosh!
Someone please go find out what closet Isao Takahata hid in to go watch a child for a year to animate how they move. Like it's like Miyazaki in Totoro, like.
Yeah, but wasn't that just his daughters? Wasn't he just like watching his kids?
Yeah, he just openly said, no, I've literally animated my children. Like,
yeah, I just watched my daughters romp around for a while, and well, now it's on screen. So I think it's the same thing. Like, man, I just had this idea that like at Studio Ghibli headquarters in Tokyo somewhere, they've got like an employee daycare on the ground floor, and there's like a gallery, like in an old like surgical theater. So you've got like, kids just like playing around. There's like all these animators like, can you have the one in the red romper? Can she drop the ball again? I need that animation.
Because again, we saw with Spirited Away, they had a certain model of Audi that was driving over cobblestones. So they went and got that Audi and they drove it over cobblestones. So when we say he probably was watching somebody's kids and just animated it, they probably were just watching someone's children and animated these children. Because, like, that's what they do. They give the authenticity you need to make these things great.
This is a conversation we were having at work about how some workplaces are results-based, where it's not about the process. It's the product at the end. Other workplaces are process-based, where it's
the product we're going to get there eventually, but what's important is the steps along the way that we have to do to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Studio Ghibli, very obviously process-based. It's about the art, not about making a profitable movie. There are other movie houses that the quality of the product at the end matters very little. What matters is making a profit. And that's not bad. That's not wrong. Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at you, MCU. You found yourself a license to print money. Are all of your movies bangers? No. Are they all profitable? Heck yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. But Ghibli, they've spun it around the other way. It's like, do I make a profit off this movie? Doesn't matter nearly as much as me killing every animator in my department.
And that's the thing. Like, this might not have turned a profit, but it is an important movie. And sometimes it's more important. You know, sometimes things are more important than making the buck.
Yeah, it's almost, I feel like it's like the button on a very great career from Isao Takahata. It's he very shortly after this and Red Turtle passed away. And I think this, like, if you're going to go out, man, like, this ain't a bad way to do it. Like,
yep.
Oh, this is very definitely going out on top with a wonderful movie that I hope will be remembered for a long, long time. I loved every second of this movie, but that's not to say that it's perfect. And I do have to say that there's a couple of things that bothered me. So this movie had a three-act structure. So to me, act one is them finding the princess and her growing up until the point where she meets the five suitors. Act two is the five suitors and their trials to try to get her attention. And then act three is the emperor and her going back to the moon.
Yep, that's fair.
My big problem with this movie was pacing.
Mm.
Where act one was fast and it was tight. And then boom, 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 boom. And then act two, just it slowed right down. And I remember looking at my watch a couple of times going, how much longer is this going to take to get? And then act three, for some reason, was even slower. Or at least it felt slow to me. And it just, the inconsistent pacing kind of bugged me. This movie seemed to start off at a cracking pace and I was in, and then it dropped.
I feel like part of that pacing change is when she was young, everything was fast, right? And then when they moved to the city, she's like a prisoner. I mean, there's that scene where she lets the bird go, where she lets the helps the, I don't know if it's a grasshopper or a praying mantis. She gets the praying mantis out and it's the only, it was a little green thing. Okay. Anyway, she feels trapped there. She feels like she's imprisoned there. And so the fact that it's slower, I think, might have been a choice to for us to feel what she's feeling.
I think I agree with Nettie. Like, in the beginning, she's happy and joyous. And then by the end of the movie, she's like super depressed. And
every time she's happy, she grows again.
Yeah.
Notice she grows every time she's happy. And then they move to the city and her growth slows way, way down.
Yep.
And, you know, she's so sad when she becomes a woman. She's from then on, she stops growing because she doesn't have that joy anymore.
The administrator that comes in to pick her name, did I see that right? Was that Oliver Platt?
No, the administrator is played by James Caan. Oliver Platt was the round-faced suitor with the white face paint.
Oh, I thought James Caan was the father.
No, sorry, not James Caan, Jason Segel.
Jason Segel, yes, yeah. Okay.
Gotcha. Not, is it Jason Segel? George Segel, sorry. Not Jason Segel, George Segel, the older one.
Okay. Yes.
Sorry, I'm just saying the wrong things out here. Yeah, no, James Caan and Mary Steenburgen were the parents, who, by the way, also are married in the movie Elf. So, like, just kind of put that in your head.
And Mary Steenburgen, also the narrator.
Yes, also the narrator.
Amazing.
Yes.
And also, you could tell she was singing her parts.
Yes, and she can sing. She's very well known to sing. Chloe Grace Moretz, I found that she can sing. I have not found anything saying she did or did not sing in this movie.
Okay.
So there is that. And then Sutemaro is played by Darren Criss, who can also sing, but he sings just a little bit. Like, anyway, he was from
Sutemaro, being the village boy that
he was in, what was that show? Glee. He was in Glee.
Oh, okay.
So he's one of the Glee guys.
So yeah, he can sing.
But they just had him sing the nursery rhyme and that was it.
Shout out to Lucy Liu being the
Sagami was Lucy Liu. That was the lady that was teaching her how to be a lady. Yeah, this was like jam packed. You had James Marsden, Beau Bridges, Oliver Platt, Daniel Day Kim, and John Cho being the suitors, and then Dean King being Emperor McRapey. Sorry, struggling right here.
There is a another wonderful character that doesn't say much, but on the screen she is a treat, and that is the princess's little handmaiden.
Yes,
who never says much, but is always just kind of there doing handmaiden stuff. And there's a scene at the end where it's, "We must all protect the princess. The moon people are coming, you know, to the battlements." And you've got all the archers on the roof and you've got the swordsmen and everybody's ready to defend. And then there's the princess in her chambers, and outside the door is the handmaiden in Seiza with a 6-foot Naginata over her lap, just ready to do business.
And that's played by Hinden Walch, which you know as Starfire from Teen Titans and Teen Titans Go.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And the cool, you know, the cool thing about her character is she's drawn chibi the entire time.
The whole time.
And so she's this very adorable kind of light character in this world that is very stark and harsh for Kaguya. And so she becomes her friend. She's the one handmaid who brings her things from outside. And she's like, you know, "I know you can't leave now because of all the suitors, so I brought you cherry blossom." And so like, she's really sweet. And I think it's a really small, but it's an integral part to the story, right? Because
compared to the Lucy Liu handmaiden, which is drawn in a very, very long lines, very, looks like a classic, you know, Japanese painting, mm-hmm. because, you know, even with the blackened teeth and the no eyebrows, you know, both of which are plot points. But the whole thing is that, you know, to your point, Jason, she's very strict and she's very official. So she's drawn in this official way. Meanwhile, the other one is her friend and is very nice. So she's drawn all chibi. Yeah. But that scene of her with the Naginata, man, I love that. That was so cute.
It's great gags because, you know, like, and it's a really good quick thing. It's not like, they're not like, "Look at it. Look at the explosions." Yeah. It's a Naginata. Like, it's none of that, right? It's just, you see it in passing and it fits the character and it's wonderful, right? Like,
yeah. There's a character in there named Kita Kata. And I don't remember what that character was, but she's played by Beau Bridges' daughter, Emily Bridges.
Huh.
So I don't know. But apparently she was also in Up on Poppy Hill. So
Beau Bridges being one of the suitors.
Yeah, being one of the suitors, yeah.
Let's get to the end of the story here. As things are going bad for the princess, and as she realizes that she's going to have to marry one of these dudes, and she's being chased by the emperor, she keeps getting these visions that the moon people are coming.
Yep.
And then, 15th of August, they're coming. And then they decide to hold up the defenses to try to protect the princess from the moon people. And, they show up. And they show up, you know, with banners flying and drums a-beating and really happy music playing. Shout out to Joe Hisashi for yet again crushing it on the soundtrack. And the moon people come. And, well, no, we're not just talking about people that live on the moon. No, these are gods. That's the Buddha. That is very definitely the Buddha. And the Buddha's wife and the full entourage coming down from heaven to take their princess back.
Yep.
Yeah. And listen, when she told them that there was nothing they could do, she really meant there was nothing they could do.
But they tried.
They did try.
They did try.
They let loose this barrage of arrows that just, the Buddha puts up his hand and they all just turn into flowers.
But you see, the thing that did defy the Buddha, though, was their love for Kaguya when they sang the song she sang as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Led by the handmaiden.
Yep.
And so even in that moment, they still could defy them. And it literally took the Buddha being like, "Man, like, guys, like."
But he never speaks, which I think was another brilliant touch they put in. The Buddha never speaks.
Nope. I'm assuming his wife does, because she's like, "Girl, you gonna forget this. Here, put this thing on."
It was great.
It's impure world.
It was a whole, I think the voice cast did very well. The story was really good. But it was definitely one of those things where you're like, when you look at it with today's eyes, there's all of these little pieces where you're like, it just doesn't make, just let the girl be happy. Just listen to the child, you know?
But it's a 1,000-year-old story. So same thing. If we look at like Hans Christian Andersen or
at
the Brothers Grimm, there's a lot of dated things in those stories too, but they're products of their time. And the fact that this story, the fact that you can tell this story and still have it mean something. Yeah. Okay. You should listen to the child. Sure. But there's a lot of really important things in there about being true to yourself, being true to your roots, and not settling for people that you know you're not going to be happy with in your entourage.
Yeah.
I mean,
and the lies that are told. I love the one who is like, he almost gets her. He almost gets her. So the suitors all compared her to these impossible treasures. So she tells them, bring the treasure back. And she tells her handmaiden at one point, she says, they don't love me. They don't value me. They just see me as a treasure, something to collect. And so they're all trying to bring back these treasures. And the first one does a fake and he doesn't pay for it. And they find out. The second one pays lots of money for a fake, but then she can prove that it's a fake because she tells him to put it in the fire. And then the next one that shows up, well, one of them ends up just absolutely getting scared of dragons everywhere. He goes crazy. And then the next one, he comes back with a flower. And he has this whole story about how he saw this flower on the side of the road and it reminded him of why he loved her and all of these great, comparisons. And you're really starting to go, oh man, he's really good. And he's saying, come away with me. I love flowers that are on the side of the road. We'll take care of each other. And then this woman comes in and like, you don't realize what's going on, but she's whispering in her ear and she sits in front of the blind and he opens it up and he sees his already wife.
Yep. It's like, oh wow, that's the same thing you said to me.
Yeah.
And the same thing you said to all those other girls.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
At first, the lady that showed up in her little like cabinet thing.
Yeah.
I thought it was her mom.
It was. So
it was her that, mom brought
okay,
her
so
in.
I wasn't
so
wrong.
That's so that was yeah. the that was the button on the scene that I thought was the best detail.
Uh-huh.
Kaguya lost. She fell for it.
Right.
Yep.
The mom comes up as Kaguya is being swayed by what he's saying.
Right.
And puts her hand on her shoulder to steady her because she's like, nah, sis, I've been around the block a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what, and it's such a good scene. It's so good.
Okay.
Because Kaguya really did fall for it. Like she honestly
yeah,
was
Yeah, I saw
she's
that swayed. And I was like, oh, well, maybe he's actually like legit in his feelings. And then, like I said, I saw the mom come in and like touch her on the shoulder. And I'm like, is the mom like seeing her emotions, like seeing that she's going for it. And then the next scene where it's his wife and she's holding the flower and she's like, she's red, like beat
she
red in the
mad.
Face.
She is.
Yeah. His.
Beat mad.
I was like,
yeah.
Wait a minute. That is not what I saw.
Listen, it is such a good scene. Mm-hmm. And then
and as soon as he sees her, he's like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And she's like, how many of your ex-wives need to go into a nunnery? It's like, oh, dang.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because, again, one of them already said that he moved his wife far away and built a new palace for her.
While he was chasing dragons.
Bro, yep. Wild, son.
And then my favorite one of the suitors is the last one who was told to collect this, like, gem or something. And he's trying to say that it's a bird's egg. So he's being held aloft.
Oh, yeah.
He's being held aloft by the villagers in like this harness as he's trying to swing up under the pagoda roof of a palace to try to collect birds' eggs. And they drop him and he lands head first in a cast iron pot and just flat out dies.
Yep.
Just that man is a corpse.
The bird lives.
The bird lives.
Bird did live. Mm-hmm.
But he did.
I don't want us to forget this though, because can we please get a really good Ghibli fantasy movie, because these dragons look awesome.
Oh yeah,
I know
the storm dragon in the ocean
coming out of the clouds,
amazing.
Yeah,
I thought that dragon looked really familiar to me with like the big claws and everything. Mm-hmm. I thought he was going to come around and tell that guy that all he had to do was collect 7 Dragon Balls and he could get one wish.
What was that other movie where it had a dragon in the storm and they were going
Earthsea?
No. Where they were going to, like, the old Mech Island up
in
the clouds.
Castle in the Sky. When they were fighting, when they're flying to the storm to see the lightning dragon.
That's what I kept thinking of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the lightning dragon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then when Kaguya gets told that this suitor has died, it breaks her heart. And she feels horribly guilty that this trick that she played on them of giving them these impossible tasks has cost one of them his life, even though she's not directly responsible. Mm-hmm. I mean, she still feels real good. And then she runs away, which is probably the most beautiful scene in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Of her running pell-mell through the woods, ripping off her robes, you know, her badges of office and all of her trappings. And then she ends up in the forest, and then she meets a lover boy from the village who is ready to leave his wife and child for her, oddly. And then Peter Pan flight scene. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and there's also the other time that she runs away. And you can never tell if the time she runs away are dreams or really happening. But she runs away and she goes to during her naming ceremony, because she's like, I'm not even at my own party. Everybody's drinking for 3 days and I'm sitting in a box drinking from shells. But she runs off and she goes to find her friends, and he's like, oh, they're not here anymore. And this is at that point that you find out what they do, what the friends in the country do. Like, her dad was a bamboo cutter, but her friends, they cut trees for charcoal, to make charcoal from. And that is like a very lowly job. And it was, yeah, no, they left because they got most of the trees. They got to go to another area because you don't want to overfarm. But don't worry, they'll be back in about 10 years. And she's like, 10 years? He says, everything comes back. Everything comes back. And that's when she goes back. She's like, okay, so all these things will come back.
I think that was a really good way of showing the passage of time, too.
Yeah.
Because we know that probably if we ever see them again, it'll be 10 years.
Yeah.
Please. And we'll
be much older.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a whole, I like the whole precursor of everything comes back when, and after she goes to the moon, more than likely she will end up back on Earth.
Yeah. But, and I think that old woman she met in the moon was herself. Her. Yeah. So it'll happen again.
But we know that she does come back.
Yeah.
Because in the 1980s, there was a collaboration between NHK, Japan's national broadcaster, and the Children's Television Workshop to do a made-for-TV movie called Big Bird Goes to Tokyo.
Ohio. Nebraska.
Yeah. Ohio gozaimasu being good morning in Japanese. So as soon as Big Bird hears people go, Ohio, he answers back with Nebraska, which is one of my favorite jokes. But Big Bird goes to Tokyo and happens to meet the Moon Princess.
Yes.
And I must have been like 6 or 7 when I saw this the first time. This came out in the mid-80s. There's a scene at the end of it where Big Bird is friends with the Moon Princess, and the Moon Princess says, I have to go now, and she goes back to the moon. The camera pans to a shot of the full moon, and you see the Moon Princess and 4 Shinto priests do this like slow walk in silhouette across the surface of the moon to traditional Japanese music. It scared the willies out of Lil Tacky. It scared me so much. And then when you guys are like, oh, there's a Princess Kaguya movie about the moon, I don't want to watch it. That scared the crap out of me when I was little. Like, I'll watch Saw again. I may even watch Hostel before I watch this. This is going to be scary AF.
Love it.
I'm glad. And then I'm like, okay, for the whole movie, like, emotions in check. Like, I'm not crying. It's a sad movie. I'm not scared. It's doing okay. And then happy triumphant music comes, pans up to the moon. It's like, here it comes. Nightmares for Lil Tacky. And then no, it's just the Buddha in a parade procession. So, and then the whole time the Buddha's around, I'm like, this is going to get scary any minute now. This is and then I'm going to hate Jen and Jason for like 15 minutes after this, but no. Well, good. So,
I don't hate fair, it is horrifying though, because the idea that they're just like, because they don't let her say goodbye. They just throw it over her shoulders and are like, let's go.
No, and they are emotionless. It's, we are bringing you back.
Yeah.
Like, we're not going to hurt you. We're not going to hurt any of your friends, but your trip is over. You're coming home.
Yep.
And it's just a fact. And you know, the Buddha, like, his expression never changes. He never says anything. The only like actual thing I see him do is wave his hand to stop the arrows.
Yeah.
And you know, they even call back to this, when the tutor is telling her that princesses don't do this, they don't do that, they don't do this. And Kaguya says, well, if that's what princesses are, then they're not human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you see that, like,
these beings from the moon are not human. They don't express feelings the way people do, but Kaguya does because she learned it. And so it's a really good message, and it's a really good ending, really powerful ending. But man, did it take a time to get there.
What was the runtime?
Well, this is also the longest Ghibli movie.
Okay, so...
About 4 minutes, I believe it was.
137 minutes.
I gotta pull it up. Yeah. So, it didn't feel like it was that long. Honestly, Mononoke felt a lot longer.
I can hear a certain teenager who's now no longer a teenager crying.
And not listening to us, so it's all good. If she's smart, either that or she's hate listening to us.
For decades.
It's like, look, they talked about me again. Will their bullying never end?
Facts. But yeah, man, I think Yamada's is the only movie where Takahata said you can have a happy ending.
I do love Yamada's.
What are his, let me bring him up here. What are the other movies of his that we have yet to see?
Okay, Grave of the Fireflies. This is the lot. So we have from Takahata, Only Yesterday, Pompoko, My Neighbor the Yamadas, and now we've watched Kaguya and Grave of the Fireflies.
He was also the director for most of the episodes of the Japanese animated version of Anna Green Gables.
Yes.
I think we need to go watch Anna Green Gables.
I'm in for that. I would definitely add that anime. If we can find that streaming, I would definitely add that into our
list. He was the director for a bunch of episodes along with Hayao Miyazaki. They did a bunch of episodes of Lupin the Third.
Yes, that is also. Oh. And we have one of our things is...
Castle of
Kaguya. The Castle of Kaguya.
That's Lupin the Third. That's the next movie we're doing.
Okay.
Listen, yep.
That's non-Ghibli.
Listen, you want to see...
Included.
Y'all want to see some animators be moited? There's a clock tower scene in that thing? Man. But yeah, man, this man's got a hefty filmography.
Yeah.
I mean...
I'm looking at my scores from My Neighbor the Yamadas. I feel like I need to watch that again because it's not as high as I thought it was.
What do you mean?
Oh, I was just saying, well, I like this, but I remember liking My Neighbor the Yamadas a little bit more. And nope, I guess I like this one more. It's fine. It was a 7.5, but.
Okay, so shall we get the scores?
Yeah, let's do this.
All right, who wants to start?
I'll go. I am going to give this an 8 out of 10 bamboo for dinners.
8 out of 10 bamboo for dinner.
Bamboo for dinners.
Okay. What's your rationale here?
Art style is amazing. Story solid. Did not feel like a slog fest to me at all. I enjoyed watching it. I was very happy. I will say that this is dazzling. It's a dazzling movie. I am a fan. I am 100% a fan. It's just, you know, maybe not as high as some of the other films. I mean, I don't go too high with a lot of them, but, yeah, I think it's very fair. And I can tell you that for my own personal rating compared to the other Takahatas so far, Pompoko actually was higher. But Only Yesterday and My Neighbor the Yamadas were a 7.5, whereas Pompoko was an 8.5 for me.
Nice. So you heard it here first, folks. Nutty supports Raccoon Death.
Apparently, yes.
Okay, I everything starts with a perfect score for me, and then we go down from there. So I am going to have to give this thing -1 point for pacing in Act 2, -1 more point for pacing in Act 3 because it got even worse. And I am going to ding it a point for writing because I love this. I just – maybe it's the dialogue. Maybe it was a crummy translation, but I just found myself wanting a little bit more in the interaction between the characters, and I think maybe a little bit of tweaking, it could have been even better than it was. There's a lot of the dialogue in there that I enjoyed, but I found it a little lacking in some places. So this is a 7 out of 10 for me. I really enjoyed it. The art was beautiful. And hey, it was a Ghibli movie with an ending. So that's 7 out of 10 impossible tasks for suitors.
And I think that a lot of the... like they had less dialogue because there was a lot of like pretty sceneries and pretty things happening, you know? Like, when we watch Budo, The Art of Killing, and we complain that I don't want to see the leaf fall into the stream, I want to see, you know, my master fighting. Yeah. There was a lot more of the leaves falling into the stream sort of a thing. Yeah. And by the way, when the way they animated sunlight through trees on the shadows as people are moving. Oh, my God.
Amazing.
So many dead animators.
How do you watercolor over another watercolor?
Exactly.
To make it an animated see-through garment.
Yep. Yeah.
Murderer. Genocidal murderer of artists.
Jen. If you're done, my turn. So I am going to give this an 8 out of 10. This is actually one of my favorite legends of time. It fits a lot with a lot of like stories and stuff that I listened to growing up in a Tlingit village. The artwork, again, as we said, was gorgeous. I enjoyed the story. I enjoyed where when she actually enjoyed life, she enjoyed nature, she enjoyed her friends and her family, and she was happy. And then you get to the point where we start looking at image and we start worrying about what other people think about money and such like that. She was no longer happy.
Yeah.
And so this is a very strong story for me. So I am going to give this 8 out of 10 pheasant soups.
Ooh, with mushrooms.
Yet again, food in a Ghibli movie, by the way.
Just the pile of ingredients looked good.
Sadly, we didn't get it, though.
Yeah.
It was probably going to look delicious.
I mean, the ingredients did.
I know.
The ingredients looked amazing.
He didn't have to animate that either. He didn't. Man. I do think this is a bit long. It just, I think the suitors could have been truncated a little and get closer to the emperor, because I think the emperor is far more poignant on the end of this story than the actual suitors.
Right.
And so for that, I will say I'll give this a 9 out of 10 cliff dive pheasant kills, because that was just funny. His immediate reaction was, oh, that hurt, but I got it.
But like, I got dinner.
I got it. Exactly. And that gives us all giving it cumulatively an 8 out of 10. So that's pretty good. And compared to other Takahata films, that is the highest that we've done for a Takahata film so far.
Like, I think this is his best film. It's not my personal fave. Again, Yamada's my personal fave, but I think he knocked this one out of the park.
Well, you rated it exactly the same, though.
Sorry.
You okay?
I'm fine.
Did you get the dinner?
Nope. The pheasant. I dropped a fan that I keep near my desk, so I'll have to get it later.
It's just blowing in the air. But as we were saying, 8 out of 10, and, it definitely did pretty well. And like I said to Jason, I said that he rated it exactly the same as My Neighbor the Yamadas too. So that's pretty darn good. But that's definitely up there, you know, in the higher side of our ratings. I mean, most of our ratings, you know, you can kind of see, like, a lot of times we don't always agree, but on this one, we pretty much were in agreement, some a little lower, some a little higher, but we were all kind of in the same range, as opposed to, say, My Neighbor the Yamadas, where someone gave it a 5 and someone gave it a 9. So, and they're both over there. But up next.
Wait, what's next, buddy?
Up next is the Castle of Cagliostro, which is a Lupin the Third, which I'm really excited about. This is the second non-Ghibli movie we'll be watching, the first one having been Nausicaä Valley of the Wind. So this is this one we'll probably want to watch subbed, right? Unless Disney came back and redid it. I don't know.
I'll have to look and see what the cast is. But Castle of Cagliostro... there have been some fantastic voice actors for Lupin. I know Sonny Strait has done it. A few of them. So yeah, I mean, it's probably a solid cast though. Either way, it's probably a solid cast.
So but, I know very little about this. I don't know anything of the plot of the movie. I know the character of Arsène Lupin, the master thief. You know, these are books that were written in France in the 1800s. He was actually written as a villain for Sherlock Holmes and then got sued because he actually stole the author of Arsène Lupin actually stole the character and in some of his books actually started calling him Herlock Sholmes to try to get around the lawsuit. We've watched a few episodes, two or three episodes of the original 1972, Lupin the Third anime, which was also directed by, Miyazaki and Takahata. That being 1971-72, that would place it near the very beginning of anime. You know, there's only a couple, franchises that I can think of that would be older.
Oh yeah, they were solidly in the afterglow of,
Speed Racer?
Osamu Tezuka.
Astro Boy.
yeah. Osamu Tezuka was gleaming in their eyes. They were definitely, you know, wanting to follow the guy that got them into doing all this type of stuff. Like, but the character of Lupin's awesome. Like, look into the lore of Lupin. It's awesome. Like, the anime Lupin, because, like, people have their favorites. He's like Doctor Who, kind of. Like, people have, like, I like Green Jacket Lupin or Pink Jacket Lupin or Blue Jacket Lupin. Like, people like different Lupins for different reasons. And it's a really interesting thing.
Netflix recently did a live-action version. Yeah. Did you guys see it?
Yeah, we watched the first scene. Yeah, it wasn't bad. I was okay with it. It's good. I'm going to check the next season. But, yeah, I didn't have any issues with it at all.
Is it as good as the live-action Cowboy Bebop?
I still need to finish that. But, I mean, I'd say they're on par.
That's all well, that's good because I didn't like Bebop.
Really? Okay.
I loved it.
I need to finish Bebop. I'm saving my judgment for that. But I also haven't watched the live action One Piece. But I'm just saying that's gonna be a biased sample when I do because I've never liked One Piece.
So my big question is, what should I do? Because I've been wanting to watch Lupin the Third for Nutty Bites anime. Should I try to watch other Lupin the Third before we watch Castle of Cagliostro? Or should I start with the Castle of Cagliostro because it is kind of like in that OG era?
I think you should start with Castle of Cagliostro because it also gives you a taste of the kind of comedy that makes Lupin what it is. Okay. And it's done in the highest setting possible. Because this movie, people love this movie. People, this movie's beautiful. Like,
okay. So that's what I will do. I will not try to spoil myself on any other Lupin the Third. It's been on my list for Nutty Bites anime, so I will start with Castle of Cagliostro.
And this will be the oldest movie that we reviewed in the series. This Castle of Cagliostro came out in 1979.
Yeah.
If you like this one, then I would suggest to you after this one called Fujiko Mine. Or I think it's I can't remember if it's a movie.
Well, let's talk about that after we review it. That's where we're headed to. If you have any thoughts, anything that you want to share with us about Princess of Kaguya, we would be very happy to hear it. So you can always just chime in on those different areas where we are. There's a Facebook group, there's Discord. We are not on Twitter. Send a carrier pigeon, all that good stuff, emails, and then we'll be back with Castle of Cagliostro. Thanks so much for joining us.
Bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Before we go, we want to thank our patrons without whom we wouldn't have two episodes a month. And we want to thank you so much for backing us. So
thanks for holding the gun to our head, guys.
Thank you to our top patron, Jax, and our other big daddies, Jason and Rich the TT.
Thanks, daddies.
Thank you to our patrons of the arts, Hugh, Mark Cabot, the Encaffeinated One, and Susanna. And thank you to all of our other patrons, our lifeblood of this campaign, keeping us going. Thank you to Shane, Selgenor, Andy, Cliff, Grig, Harold, Ian, Justine, Ken, Kinsey, Melissa, Mike, PCAT, Radical Geek, Will, and Zachman. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.
Nutty Bites is produced by Nimlas Studios under a Creative Commons Attribution No Commercial Non-Derivatives 3.0 International License. That means you can't change it without my permission. You can share it and send it to your friends. Just link back to me, my site, and everything. We live at nimlas.org, which has links to everything social media, including facebook.com/group/nuttybites and patreon.com/nukejoss, or call 347-NUTTY42.